going up, how many people coming back down will take place in those 4 years. That's a lot of dependence on somebody else. WS2N, K2RIW.
They've gone as long as 6 months, but it's usually around 4.5, 5 months, that range, when you'll send a Soyuz up. Well, one will come down usually first, and then another one will go up. So that's constantly keeping, you know, at least three on board the space station for a short period of time. The other one undocks, you know, so then you get three, and then another one comes back up. So most of the time, they'll have six on board the ISS. Talk about 4 or 5 months. Every 4 or 5 months, you'll have a space launch from Kazakhstan.
So that's about three launches per year for 4 years. So there's 12 more launches going to take place. That's somebody else's hardware besides our hardware, if I'm being a little bit on the pessimistic side. And when it comes to the total number of launches, we've got to talk about the progress ships that bring up the consumables, and as well as people on the way up and people on the way down. It's amazing to me that we tolerated that length of time of no real manned launch capability of our own. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they've had this Orion spacecraft on the board for a while. They could have been doing both, I guess, at the same time. But that's the way it goes. You know, I mean, there was a big lull, I think a 6-year lull between Apollo. Well, actually, Apollo Skylab missions and the first launch of the space shuttle. So we had a big gap there. The only difference is we didn't have a International Space Station flying around that's permanently manned. So, you know, there's a bit of a difference. Meanwhile, China's working on their space station. They're going to put up a piece of it, I think, next year and add to it. So they did. You know, other countries are going along, but I think we're going to catch up real quick again, especially once this rocket is built. I mean, this thing is big. I wonder if they're going to have to increase the size of the vehicle assembly building where they put these things together and drop it. The original Apollo Saturn rolled out of the vehicle assembly building. It was actually Apollo 4. It was a test flight. First Saturn V actually to be launched. When they put that all together, on top of at the very top, you know, they have these rockets to pull away. You know, it's an escape mechanism. These escape rockets fire to pull the in those days the Saturn spacecraft away from the Apollo spacecraft away from the Saturn booster, in case there was an emergency. So, I mean, it just fit, and then they realized, well, there was a one lightning rod that had to be attached to the top of that, and it didn't fit. They had to actually put that on later. It wouldn't roll out of the vehicle assembly building. So I'm sure they changed that for later flights, but this thing here is going to actually be about, I think, 40 feet taller than the Saturn V, so maybe they'll have to raise the height of the vehicle assembly building there.
Do you happen to know how many feet tall is the main dock bay door, if you know what I mean, of the vertical assembly building? I'm guessing it's more than 350 feet. Is that true, Paul? And I was there once. I should have asked that question. They took me up in the elevator in that place, and I saw it from top down. But I wasn't smart enough to ask how many feet up I was. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, I was there. I forgot the numbers. I looked a couple of months ago on on the internet. You could go, you know, virtual tours on the internet of the vehicle assembly building. You could see how the shuttles are all mounted and all, you know, brought in from. They had another building that they would prepare the shuttle and then they would roll it in, you know, roll it in like an airplane on wheels, and then all these gigantic planes would raise the shuttle up. How they did all of this, and they talk about the height. And offhand, I don't know. Let's see. The Apollo was what, 363 feet, I think it was. This thing's gonna be like a little over 400 feet. So, you know, figure another maybe 20 feet beyond that. Probably 440 feet or something like that, I guess. High there. So, I mean, when it was built, it had its own. It would develop its own clouds inside. It was so big.
I once climbed the tower out at Brookhaven Laboratory, which I think is something like 320 feet, a guide tower. We've also seen the tower at Sunnyside Boulevard, which I think is around 320 feet. Also the one that used to be Channel 67 at around exit 55. That's also a 300-some-odd-foot high tower. So to get a feeling for a 400-foot high space vehicle, wow. That's really up there. And once you build a building that big in a place like Florida, and you got to worry about hurricanes, tornadoes, and so on, and make the building strong enough, it's a pretty serious challenge. What's the next thing that's going to be launched? Well, first of all, I know that if the Mars Curiosity, I think it's about as big as a Volkswagen automobile, and you've told us once before how much it weighs, and it was quite a weighty thing. If you could go to the appropriate website of NASA, and you dial in NASA Mars Curiosity, or Mars Science Laboratory, I think it's called, they show you an animation of what the landing sequence of that thing looks like. Very exciting thing to look at. So that's our next big launch, and what's coming after that, if you happen to know, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, I pay attention to, you know, quite a few of the launches, including the Russians. So, you know, like I said, they'll be going, tomorrow morning, you know, you've got the Russians launching. Curiosity is the 25th of this month, so that's the next big thing. And then after that, are you looking for something after Curiosity, Dick? I don't know what the next big thing after that would be. What robotic mission would be going up? No, I'd have to go through the NASA calendar. You go onto the NASA site, you light up their calendar, and they tell you what's going on. And how heavy is this thing? About five times bigger than Spirit or Opportunity. And roughly five times bigger, so give you an idea, the wheels are about, 33 inches in diameter, where Spirit wheels were, I think, about 12 inches or so in diameter. They say it was, Spirit was the size of a golf cart, and this thing is, you know, the size of a Toyota. Weight-wise, it's very heavy, you know, five times heavier. That's the reason they need that big Atlas V launch vehicle. The actual weight, I think I remember around a little over 2,000 pounds as it rides around on Mars.
Wow. And the major source of power for the Curiosity, what's the number of watts, and what's the major source of that power, Paul? Go ahead.
I forgot the amount of watts, but it's naturally a lot more. And, you know, it's watt hours. That's the most important thing. Because of the solar panels on Spirit and Opportunity, you know, they were very good in the day, and, but they'd have to shut it off early because they'd have to keep the power, you know, going at night. They used a lot of power to keep everything going, the computers and the heaters to keep the batteries warm and all. You know, it was really a daytime machine. This thing's going to be a day and nighttime machine because it's got an RTG, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator on board. So with that, you'll be able to run 24 hours. So let's hope this thing works. They're only sending one. It's not two. Remember, you know, I mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, probably many times, that I wish they were sending two, but that $2.5 billion, I guess they didn't want to go for $5 billion back either.
Yeah, I'm glad I asked. I kind of thought that it was a radioactive power generator, which in theory could last a decade as far as the power generator is concerned, with slight decrease in power output in time. Has anyone predicted how long Curiosity is likely to run? Question number one. Question number two, I'm a little bit amazed that when you get winds like 200 miles an hour on Mars, it's a very tenuous wind, you know, 0.5% of the Earth's atmospheric pressure, but still it's a very high velocity wind. I really wish there was a microphone on board so we could hear that wind periodically. To my knowledge, none of the Mars landers contained an acoustic microphone. It'd be really nice to hear that wind whistling by once in a while, because I'm sure there's some hidden information there, as you know, some kind of a sonic boom occurring over the horizon. You'd like to know about that. What's your best guess as to how long Curiosity is likely to last, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, I think the Mars Polar Lander, which was a failed Martian mission, had a microphone on board. And then when they sent up the two rovers, yeah, they didn't have it. I thought Phoenix, the one that landed on the northern portion of Mars, you know, that wasn't a rover. I think that might have had a mic on board. I believe that one did. But whether or not it worked or not, I'd have to check. I thought that one had it. But yeah, I wanted to hear. I want to hear the wheels going. I want to hear the mechanics of the thing going back and forth. You know, the linkages opening and closing, whatever. I think that would be great. 2 year predicted mission for Curiosity. Remember the other ones were. They would have been happy, you know, if they got 30 days or so out of the spirit and opportunity. Now here we are coming up, I think on January 4th will be 7 years, and then the 14th, I think, was the other one landed 2 weeks later. Opportunity landed 2 weeks later, so. All right, Spirit's dead, but Opportunity will be coming up to 7 years. That landed in 2004, Dick.
We sure got our money's worth out of that one. In the case of a microphone, it would be nice to hear the motors turning. And so if you're getting a dirt ground up in one of the bearings of one of the wheels, you could hear the sound and they give you an additional piece of information. Although they've really got it by way of the telemetry on board telling you how much current each motor is drawing and how many RPM you got up getting out of each one of the wheels. They've really got the information. But it's nice to have the sound. Sound and vision. It's almost as good as being there. But that mission of the Russians for landing on the moon, Phobos and Deimos are the two moons of Mars, which I think translates into fear and panic or something like that. Anyhow, so they're going to land on one of those, scoop up some of the soil, and bring it back. Ambitious. And so right now I guess you're saying it's stuck in Mars, in Earth parking orbit. And that could be kind of exciting if they can't reestablish communication. And once again, how many pounds of this toxic fuel is on board, and what's the number of miles of that parking orbit? If the parking orbit is 200 miles up, which I vaguely remember you saying. Now, that could last quite a while before it re-enters. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, don't write this in stone, but I think it was 7 tons. I think they said 14,000 pounds of hydrazine fuel, highly toxic stuff, plus the spacecraft itself. That might be a combination of both. In that case, it would be half and half. Usually, on a deep space mission, the fuel constitutes half the weight of this, of what's being sent there. It's the easiest way to think of it. So, you know, you got a 2,000-pound thing, half, you know, 1,000 of it is usually fuel. And that holds true for a lot of the deep space missions. Altitude was around, a little over 100 miles, only about 115 miles, so I think it was 120. And, yeah, no, that's coming back fast. They're predicting a December 3rd re-entry, Dick. And if there was another question, I forgot.
K2M. Okay, December 3rd, possible re-entry. I heard somebody signing in, K2 something or other. Give me your call letters again after the 4 beeps.
Hey, call us 202, Mike, Uniform, Foxtrot, K2NUF. Name is Joe. Just had a quick question.
Okay, a little bit noisy, but we're hearing you, Joe. K2, Mike, Uniform, Foxtrot. Go right ahead with your question, Joe.
Okay, yeah, number one, you remember about a month ago, I was talking about you couldn't reach the repeater from out here in East End or Long Island. I believe the one out here east was kind of... Well, I can hear it half scale now, and you're just about making me hear now with about 25 or 30 watts. So whatever they did to it a couple of weeks ago, they fixed it a little bit, but it's not 100% fixed. My one question was, is there enough air on Mars for sound to travel?
Oh, Mars has... Let me drop it. Mars has a 0.5%, roughly, of the air pressure we have on Earth. And that air, from time to time, will move at 200 and some odd miles an hour, and it will kick up dust. So there is air on Mars, there will be sound. Anything above zero air pressure, you're going to get sound. And lately I've been looking into a little bit about what's really happening at the molecular level. Where does sound come from? Where does air pressure come from? It's quite different from what you think. Each of those air molecules on the Earth at standard atmospheric temperature and pressure, each one of those air molecules is moving 500 meters per second of average speed. And I'm not kidding. And what you and I call air pressure, 14.7 pounds per square inch, it's not because those air molecules are packed and tight to each other and pushing against each other. That's not it at all. That air pressure is coming from the fact that some of them are going in the direction of the wall of your chamber, we'll say. They strike the wall and bounce off. That's what's creating the 14.7 pounds per square inch. Zillions of air molecules moving 500 meters per second. That's what? 1.4 times the speed of sound is the average speed of the air molecules in the room with you now. Crazy stuff. Opposite from common sense. Okay. So apparently the repeater out there, once they fix the power output of the final stage, let me drop. I do know that after Eric did that repair, he then did a trip on the South Fork out east and measured signal strength versus distance. And so he thought it was essentially back to normal operation. Although you may be using as a criteria, Joe, the fact that you do get some band openings out there from time to time, and once in a while, particularly in the summer, you'll get some real long propagation. You'd like that to happen every day, and maybe it can't. But then again, I know that you've been suspicious that there was a change in the antenna pattern, because not only is it lower in power output on transmit, but it was low on receive sensitivity from your point of view, which does suggest an antenna problem. So maybe a further test. I think Eric did say he was going to eventually do a further test of the antenna. I believe he measured the standing wave ratio when he repaired that amplifier. That's your first criteria, is the feed line properly connected, doesn't have water, and so on. Well, the nasty thing about water is that if the water got into the feed line and it's properly distributed, it might not show up as standing wave ratio, even though it creates an insertion loss on both transmit and receive. And so maybe that's what you're experiencing. From a rough point of view, what kind of range did you used to get on the average day, Joe, and what kind of range are you getting now to that 147.375 repeater? K2 Mike Uniform Foxtrot, maximum usable frequency, K2 RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Okay, K2RIW in TechNet, K2MUF. Yeah, we're on 147.375 right now. The Selden repeater, I believe. I noticed right off the bat here that Echo has been working for the last...
did a heroic job of gathering all this information But his introductory chapter says that he's telling you what these people have reported. He hasn't necessarily confirmed all these reports himself. Wonder if you had a chance to take a look at that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Even Dick, everybody on the net. Yes, I did. That was pretty hefty. I think it's 6,000 pages or something like that. Yeah, I looked at a few of them, and I was interested in one particular gentleman who's working with the yoke construction, who found a difference in his resonant frequencies. That's the one I spent a little bit of time on. But there were so many machines and so many. It would take you a week to read that with any type of recognition. Very interesting article, and I'm sure Wesley's going to have a lot to say about it. Back to you, Dick.
Did I hear you say, John, that you've built one of these, I guess, toroid-like things, or the ones with the counter-winding, and you've got a slightly different frequency? Is that what you're saying, John? Go ahead.
No, one of the gentlemen had an article. He had four different videos, and he was constructing a yoke, and Wesley is very much about the tuning. He found that different frequencies were coming about with his tuning, and I mean, they were way out of whack, where Wesley is working with 50 hertz and around 400 kilohertz. He was working with 50 hertz and up in the megahertz, 7 megahertz, and he was finding different things. But the toroid, ferrite might be different. The style of the windings may have caused the problem. Not sure. Seems to be a competent guy, but there's a lot left to there's a lot to be desired with some of their descriptions. And later I have a question on some other topic.
The magnetic yoke mechanism that's on most cathode ray tube type television sets, and I guess many of the video display devices, each brand name quite possibly uses its own ferrite material, what mu level, what size, how many turns, and whatever. So I see the possibility that although you may have the ferrite magnetic yoke assembly from a cathode ray tube device, doesn't mean they're all the same. So you've got differences in the materials, differences in the spacing between the two halves, whether or not you put paper in that gap. And so winding the same number of turns on what physically looks the same as far as a photograph is concerned could give you quite a bit of difference. But before we go there, what's your question on, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
My question was on air pressure, a study on air pressure.
Fire away.
Okay, if we were to take an isotropic radiation of of an explosion, we have a detonation, let's say something, maybe a ton of TNT, small. When that rapid expansion happens, what is left in the center core? Is that a negative pressure? Does the pressure stay equal? Interested in your comments on that, Dick.
I think this is fairly similar to what happens when you fire a projectile out of a gun, particularly a long rifle. The gunpowder goes off, creates an extremely high pressure. That high pressure propels the projectile. It propels a hell of a lot of other gaseous materials that are behind the projectile. So a lot of stuff is moving at a zillion miles an hour, so to speak, at least 1,000 miles an hour, moving down that barrel. When the projectile leaves and when the rest of the high pressure wave leaves the end of that barrel, I'm convinced that what is left over in the barrel during the first millisecond, without a doubt, in my mind, is a partial vacuum. You've propelled a lot of stuff, and it doesn't suddenly stop. It's going to keep right on going until almost everything has left the barrel. And I think part of the action of a silencer, and a very number of people have used certain brand names of silencers and say, but they hear a hissing sound at the end of the shot, as long as your ears haven't been damaged. And I think that is the air running back into the barrel, and controlling the way the air runs back in is part of the silencing action, I am guessing. So by the same token, when you have a spherical explosion, a chunk of TNT that's gone off, without a doubt you've made an extremely high pressure at the point of the explosion. You've propelled an awful lot of massive materials. Air has got a lot more mass than makes common sense. 2.7 pounds per cubic meter. What is that? 1.2 kilograms per cubic meter is what air weighs. That's the mass of air. And so that mass of substance, you've given almost all of those nearby air molecules a tremendous amount of excess velocity in a particular direction outward. They don't suddenly stop. So I'm convinced that every explosion instantaneously has a partial vacuum at the point of the explosion, some number of milliseconds downrange. And the air comes back in and bounces, so to speak, is my best guess. So you're moving a lot of massive stuff, and it's got a lot of inertia, and it's going to keep moving for a while. Very similar to what happens when you compress a spring with a weight on the end of it, and you let go of the weight, and you let go of the spring. Let's assume now you've got a horizontal spring, a horizontal weight on a well-lubricated track. You compress the spring, and you let go. The weight is going to go beyond the neutral point, so to speak, and the spring is going to go from being in compression to periodically being in tension. And it's going to swing back and forth in that mode. I think air does something very similar. KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, Dick. Let me wait for the four beats. Okay. Before, when I was listening to you, I think you represented the weight of air due to the fact that the vibration of the molecules against the confinement of the container was what caused the weight. Did I hear that right?
No, I meant to say air pressure. When you and I measure air pressure of 14.7 pounds per square inch at standard temperature, sea level, standard temperature and pressure, also could be represented as 101,000 pascals, which is newtons per square meter. We're not quite as familiar with that one. But the 14.7 pounds per square inch is not weight. That is pressure. Pressure is caused by not the air molecules pushing up against each other. Good common sense. You think that, you know, they're packed in real tight. What's really going on is that on average those air molecules are moving 500 meters per second. A significant percentage of them are moving at essentially right angles to the wall of your chamber. They strike the wall and bounce back with a nearly perfect bounce, and that bouncing action exerts a force. I mean, if I had a whole lot of billiard balls on a table, and I'm randomly sending them against the far wall of the table, and they're all bouncing off this perfect pool table, I could measure an average pressure against that wall of the pool table, that cushion of the pool table. Those air molecules are very light, quite a bit like a whole bunch of a billiard balls, all being sent against that cushion and bouncing off of it. So that's what air pressure really is in my mind right now. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, just one more question. If we were to have a tube constructed with some type of transducer at one end, and we could fire a column of sound at decent power, at 20 feet away, shouldn't we be able to measure an increase in temperature, being that the molecules are traveling at a different rate? An increase or a decrease?
If you had sensitive enough equipment, John, that responded fast enough, and you just transmit an ordinary sound wave out of a loudspeaker, And you and I know that that so-called longitudinal wave consists of cyclic high pressure and low pressure regions that are moving out in a spherical manner and eventually becomes a planar wave. Those individual areas of high pressure and low pressure, cyclically happening at the frequency coming out of the loudspeaker, does represent areas of higher and lower pressure. It does represent areas of higher and lower temperature. So if you could have some kind of instrumentation that moved along with that wave, and you measured the forward edge of the high pressure area, you're going to measure a higher temperature, and you measure the forward edge of the low pressure area, you're going to measure a lower temperature. So you could say that the air temperature is cyclically changing along with that cyclic pressure change on an ordinary sound wave. Now, the amount of temperature change for a normal volume of sound wave, because our ears are so darn sensitive, let me drop. The actual amount of power that's in a sound wave, that's at the threshold of human hearing at 1 kilohertz, is so darn small that we're probably talking about a micro degree of change in temperature. But there is a change of temperature in my mind. And so when you bring that to the ridiculous extreme of a nearly supersonic aircraft, you could say that's part of the mechanism by which the leading edge of that aircraft becomes hot. That's where you're generating the high pressure wave. Or you could say that you're continuously impacting, and I'm using the word impacting in quotes, because none of the air molecules literally touch the surface of the leading edge of that wing. They come very close and bounce off of it. But that bouncing action, call it the ping pong paddle effect, means that the air molecules that were moving toward the leading edge, and then the leading edge encounters them, they leave at a greater velocity. That greater velocity is the beginning of that sound wave. They leave at a higher temperature. You could say it's because of compression, P equals NRT. That tells you how much. It doesn't tell you why. In my mind, the ping pong paddle effect is where the extra temperature, the extra pressure, the extra velocity is coming from. Over to you, John, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, then if I have it right, our instrumentation would have to follow the compression wave to detect a temperature rise for a specific amount of time. And if it followed the lower pressure wave, it would measure a lower temperature. But, of course, all of this would have to follow with the wave, which is almost impossible. But okay, I just wanted to clear that up because I was thinking about that this week. But thanks for that answer. Let's see what Wesley has if you want, Dick. Over to you.
John, the only reason why your instrumentation would have to follow the wave is because almost everything you and I know about that measures temperature has a time constant problem to it. It's got some kind of mass. Like, I could easily measure the temperature with a thermometer, but that's got a time constant of 60 seconds. I could measure the temperature with a very, very small thermistor, and that's got a time constant of a couple of seconds. If I could measure the instantaneous temperature of air with a very low mass device of some kind, then I wouldn't have to follow it. I would see what you and I call a sound wave, which is going up and down in pressure, would be going up and down in temperature, I'm almost positive. Not perfectly positive, but almost positive. So the only reason you and I have got to move along with the wave is because of the time constant of our measuring device. Yep. And the fastest measuring device I know of are these extremely tiny thermistors. I think some of them have got a time constant of like a second or so. There's a kind of very small thermistor-type thermometer, which is digitally operated these days. You put it under a person's tongue, and it measures the temperature in about 2 seconds. I wonder if you've ever seen one of those on some of the programs. I think Dr. Martin uses one of those from time to time, if you ever watch that British program. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Oh, yes, I have. Interesting. Also, I have an infrared gun, which is pretty quick and very accurate. In fact, I have two of them, and they've helped me out in a lot of problems with lamp temperatures and things like that. I've never tried to read any sound pressure temperatures with it, but maybe it'll work.
If they would allow you to go to the actual detecting device inside and put an oscilloscope there, transparent, and it's very difficult to measure the temperature of a transparent fluid. You've got to somehow make the fluid non-transparent. You have to put some fog, some foggy substance in the air in front of the loudspeaker. But if you could tap into the detector inside of your infrared temperature sensing machine, I think you would see a cyclic change in temperature when you got that loudspeaker running at some good size volume. It is my guess that in order to not have the digital display dance, in order for the digits to sit still, they have added an integrator after that detector. And you got to get in front of that integrator to see this effect. The right way to do it, because there's going to be a lot of random variable before that integrator. Let me drop. I heard two cycles of somebody's audio coming through, and then it dropped out. Maybe it's an IRLP attempt. Because there's a lot of random noise before the integrator on a sensitive detector, that's always true. You'd have to make that before the integrator. You'd have to make a synchronous detector. Because you know the exact frequency coming out of the loudspeaker, because it happens to be the exact same frequency coming out of your audio amplifier. And if you use that as the synchronization frequency for a synchronous detector, you would now be able to see that cyclic sine wave in temperature. See, I, a couple of years ago, was working on an experiment where I had an extremely noisy signal, but I knew I had a very weak 1 megacycle sine wave buried in that noise. Under ordinary circumstances, to read that 1 megacycle signal would be very difficult, but I set up a synchronous detector to look for that particular frequency at the exclusion of all others. You could call it a little bit like your 3561 dynamic signal analyzer. In fact, there's a way to do it. If you set your dynamic signal analyzer, John, say for instance you've got a 1 kilohertz note, let me drop. You've got a 1 kilohertz note coming out of your hi-fi amplifier going into a loudspeaker. You put some smoke in the air so that it's now got some opacity to it. Make sure that you use smoke that is infrared opaque, or at least partially absorptive to infrared. Aim your infrared sensor at the air in front of that loudspeaker with the smoke in it. Take the sampling oscilloscope, take the oscilloscope probe, connect it to the detector mechanism inside of your infrared temperature measuring machine. Choose the spot in the schematic diagram that is in front of its integrator. You're looking at the raw detected signal, infrared detected signal. Put that noisy signal into your dynamic signal analyzer and look for the 1 KC note, and you're going to find it. You're going to therefore be seeing the temperature variation of the air molecules in front of that loudspeaker because you're putting a 1 KC sine wave into it. That would be a beautiful experiment that should be written up as somebody's master's thesis or bachelor's thesis in a college course, John. I think you see the principle of operation there. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, and it sounds almost doable. Now, Dick, would I have to have the sensor part of a wavelength away to pick up the compression area rather than the low pressure?
Let me think about that one now. Yeah, the next problem is, hold on now, a 1 KC note, because sound is moving at roughly 1 millisecond per foot. So a 1 KC note has a complete sine wave coming out of that loudspeaker, the sine wave in the Z dimension, has a wavelength of 1 foot. If you could make a sheet of fog that is a fraction of a foot thick, and there's ways you can do that, you could make some kind of a fog-generating device down below the loudspeaker that's shooting fog up vertical, and as long as you can make that sheet of fog small compared to 1 foot. And by the way, you don't have to do it at a 1 kc note. You could do it at a 100 hertz note, where now the wavelength in air is 10 feet, and you only need 1 foot of fog, if you know what I mean, a 1 foot thickness of fog. So as long as you make the thickness of the fog that you're aiming your infrared sensor at to be a small fraction of a wavelength, then it will see that cyclic temperature variation, which is the sound wave. You just want to make sure that your infrared-looking device, you don't want it to be looking through three wavelengths at once, because it's going to mishmash them all together and you're not going to see the effect. So as long as you can make the sheet of fog small in thickness in the Z dimension, the dimension of propagation of the sound wave, and you aim your detector at that sheet of fog, I think you're going to see this effect. Sometimes somebody go and do that. You've got the technology, John. KC2WGB. What a scientist. K2RIW.
Yeah, well, I'll wait for my dog to give me a comment on that one. What I'm thinking about is the compression of the high spot of the sound wave and the low. If they mix, we're going to get cancellation. If I hit it at the crossover point, there will be no temperature increase. So I have to make sure. Now, how am I going to do that with a 1 foot width at 100 cycles? I don't think I'll be in the right area unless I move that smoke chamber up and down or the distance away from the speaker until I find the right one. What do you think about that?
Okay. The smoke chamber. There's got to be some kind of material that's like tissue paper, where you've got two layers of tissue paper parallel to each other. Let me pick a number, an inch apart. Some kind of material like tissue paper. So you've got a square foot of tissue paper, a pair of them, a foot apart, in some kind of a frame. And you've got something that is infrared opaque inside of that frame. And you hold the frame in front of the loudspeaker. The frame is an inch thick. The wavelengths that you're sending out of the sound wave at a 1 kc note are 1 foot long. But you've only got a one inch thickness of the smoke that's inside this frame. So now you've got to choose, I called it tissue paper, you've got to choose something that is infrared transparent, or maybe the tissue paper itself you could measure, but it'd be nice if you had something like tissue paper that's infrared transparent. You've got smoke in the air that's in the chamber. This whole frame, that's like a picture frame, is held in front of the loudspeaker, and now you've aimed your infrared sensing device at the forward edge of this thing. So it's looking at the smoke, and that smoke is going up and down in temperature at a 1 kilohertz rate as that sound wave propagates through that frame, that chamber. You see where I'm going on this one, John? So you could make a constant amount of smoke that's sitting still. You don't even have to continuously be generating it once it's inside that frame. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
I think I have the perfect type of tissue paper. I have architectural tracing paper. Pretty strong stuff. I could separate that by an inch on sort of a tennis racket frame and fill the center of it with smoke. Something like that, right there.
You got it, John. As long as you can choose the right kind of smoke, which is infrared tissue paper on the forward edge and the back edge of your tennis racket, so that it is infrared transparent. So you're trying to choose a sheet of material that's infrared transparent, but the right kind of smoke that's infrared absorptive, on the assumption that your device runs on infrared frequencies. You'll soon find out what wavelength your temperature sensor runs at. And with the right choice of the materials, you've now got this sheet of absorptive air in front of the loudspeaker, and you're pouring sound through it, and you're putting your scope probe at just the right spot inside of your thermal detecting machine in front of its integrator. And now That signal goes into your dynamic signal analyzer, and you're looking for the 1KC note. And I think you're going to see it. You're going to see the cyclic temperature change of the air because sound is going through it. I'm pretty sure it's gonna be there, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, that sounds good. In fact, I'm making notes on this at the same time. Yeah, at least I got a starting point for it. And I believe the infrared detector might see something. And I think I have 3 stages of amplification before the integrator. So right on the front end, right at the sensor. So I should be able to get into that. That should be no problem. At least if they're discreet, they're not even a chip. Nice little item.
I am curious, what is the brand name and model number of your temperature sensor, and what do you believe is its normal time constant? Does it respond in roughly a second or so?
You can vary the integrating time. I would say, well, when I pointed at a motor, less than a second.
Wow, you can point it at a motor. In other words, you're measuring the temperature of the frame of the motor. I understand. At first I thought there's a propeller on the shaft of the motor and you're looking at the temperature of the propeller as it goes by. Which optical sensors, they have kinds of optical sensors that measure RPM of radio control model airplane engines by doing that. But that's optical sensing. But this temperature effect, that could be fun. Now, you've got a couple of disturbing factors here. The sound wave itself is going to be giving you a little bit of deflection of what I call your sheets of paper, but by aiming the angles just right, you can find ways of getting around that. Yeah, if you go right down the z-axis with your temperature sensor, I think the fact that the sheet of paper is in micro inches moving toward you and away from you, that effect can be wiped out. So just choosing the right transparent materials with absorptive fog in the air at that particular wavelength. So somebody makes a gaseous substance you can put in there, which is, if your sensor is an infrared sensor, you can find out what wavelength it's working at, and somebody makes a fog-like material that is absorptive at that wavelength. And so, boy, that's going to be kind of fun. We're getting down to some very basic physics here, John, but as I see it, what we call a pressure wave, let me drop this. What we call a pressure wave in sound has to be air molecules in that vicinity moving at a higher velocity. And what we call a rarefaction wave is air molecules in that vicinity moving at a lower velocity. That's the only way air is able to exert pressure against a loudspeaker, against a microphone, against the wall of your chamber, against your pressure sensing device that measures 14.7 pounds per square inch. Each of those air molecules have a certain velocity. This is now on the assumption you're always operating at standard pressure. I'll admit that you can now put air in a tank at a higher pressure, which means you get a larger number of molecules packed in closer together. If we always restrict ourselves to air at the room temperature, at room pressure, sea level pressure, but now we're talking about instantaneous pressure going up and down. That's what a sound wave is when it hits that microphone diaphragm. Those air molecules are moving faster or slower. That's what we call a pressure wave. And now you're about to get a beautiful confirmation of that. We've been looking at this the wrong way up till now. We assume that those air molecules are alongside of each other with springs in between them. And we're compressing and stretching those springs. That's not it at all. A gas doesn't behave that way. There's a tremendous amount of empty space in between every one of those air molecules by a 30 or 35 to 1 ratio. The diameter of each one of those air molecules and the space between them is a 35 to 1 ratio. From the point of view of each one of those air molecules, they're moving around at almost free space, and they're running into some of their buddies every so often. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, and if I remember correctly, you said that in between the air molecules is a pretty neat vacuum. So I guess you're right. If we had that spherical explosion, chasing the molecules away at a very high rate of speed, we have nothing left but that original space that was between the molecules, I would assume.
Yeah, when you see this beautiful program that's now called The Fabric of the Cosmos, there's a series of four programs on NOVA. And one of them is on empty space, one of them is on time, and you see how much empty space there really is. Yes, the majority of what's in that room with you right now, John, and me too, is extremely perfect vacuum, with a small amount of that space being taken up with these air molecules. And each individual air molecule is an amazing thing. The biggest thing I know of that people can easily relate to, as you heard me before, is the Wembley Stadium in London. This particular football stadium is a kilometer in diameter, roughly 1,000 feet in diameter. And it's got a great big high ceiling. Assume it's a spherical object, 1,000 feet in diameter. And you've taken one of those air molecules, you took an oxygen molecule, and you blew it up to that size so that the outer ring of electrons filled up that space of Wembley Stadium. One single oxygen molecule atom has built up that large in size. Let me drop. There's going to be 8 protons and 8 neutrons in the center of that molecule. That's the nucleus. That nucleus has a diameter of 3.2 centimeters. 1 1/4 inches is the total diameter of the nucleus of that great big molecule filling up that whole stadium. 1 1/4 inches diameter is the nucleus. The nucleus is made up of a whole bunch of little protons and neutrons. Each one of them is roughly 1/10 that size. They are 1/8 inch in diameter is a proton in that size. 1/8 inch in diameter and 1,000-foot diameter sphere of that stadium. That's one proton. And the protons are made up of quarks and, they're made up of quarks. And those quarks are individual particles. And I don't know if anybody knows the size of a quark, but there's a whole bunch of empty space there too, which is probably another 10-to-1 change in size. You can easily see the vast majority of that oxygen molecule is empty space. 99.999% of it is empty space. That's one particular oxygen atom. Put a pair of them together, we call it O2. The diameter of that O2 molecule is a little bit more than an angstrom, 10 to the minus 10 meters. That's 0.1 nanometer is the diameter, and there's 3 nanometers on average to the nearest brother. So there's a 30 or 35-to-1 ratio of the diameters versus the space. So you got a tremendous amount of space inside the molecule or the atom. You got a tremendous amount of space in between them. And all of that space is a hard vacuum. The majority of what's in your room and my room is vacuum. And these individual oxygen molecules, for instance, and nitrogen molecules, they strike the wall every so often. And they bounce off, and that's what you and I say every...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You got Avogadro's number of them in every cubic foot, 10 to the 23rd, in other words, 1 with 23 zeros after it. That's the number of air molecules that's in one cubic foot. I'm rounding off the numbers a little bit. Tremendous number of them. And on average, they're all moving 500 meters per second. What you and I call air pressure is... those guys bouncing off the wall or bouncing off the diaphragm of your microphone and so on. But almost all of it is empty space of very rapidly moving particles, and the particles themselves are almost all empty space. How come the schools you and I went to, John, didn't give us anywhere near that image of what the universe is really like at the molecular level? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
TSL.
You want to pick that up, please?
Yeah, John first, and then we'll go to Mr. TSL. Go ahead, John.
This is N6TSL, a visitor to your area, just scanning through the frequencies, and I stumbled on your conversation. I'm listening on the side.
Go Very fine. Mr. N6TSL, what is your name, sir? My name is Dick. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey.
N6TSL, my handle is Tom, and I'm visiting in the Clifton.